Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For all the years and all the deaths now, the sacrifices of American military men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan can seem far away. But not to those who have served and seen the sacrifice. They know the time and place and cost in life and dreams. On this Memorial Day weekend, we'll hear their stories of lost comrades in arms. This hour, On Point servicemen and women remember lost comrades in the post-9/11 wars. You can join the conversation. Who do you want us to remember on this Memorial Day? What soldier, Marine, airman, sailor, what brother, what sister, father, mother, friend? We've invited servicemen and women on this hour to remember fallen comrades. We'll go straight to them. On Point News analyst Jack Beattie joins me from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, thanks very much for being here.
Pleasure, Tom.
Joining us first today from Quantico, Virginia, is Major Trent Gibson, a Marine Corps instructor for the Naval ROTC at Virginia Tech University. He was company commander of Corporal Jason L. Dunham, who was killed in Iraq on April 14, 2004. Corporal Dunham was awarded the Medal of Honor January 11, 2007. He remains the only U.S. Marine to receive that highest of awards in the post-9/11 wars. His extraordinary tale is, well, I'll leave that to Major Gibson. He was just a few hundred yards away from Corporal Dunham in the Iraqi town of Karabila when a firefight began. Major Gibson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can you remind us first just of the young man, Corporal Dunham, who you commanded?
Well, Corporal Dunham was an extraordinary young man. And his talents, his genuine nature, his selflessness, his leadership potential came to light shortly after he came to our company in October of 2003. And I've been asked to talk about him a lot in the past couple years. The first time was in summer of 06. I was invited to come up to Dunham's hometown, Scio, New York, and speak at the dedication of the town's post office to his name.
Mm.
And I'd been working on what I was going to say to the townspeople of Scio about him for about a week, but hadn't gelled all my thoughts. And the evening prior, I was talking to my company executive officer, Lieutenant Rudy Salcedo, and one of my platoon commanders, Lieutenant Dave Fleming. And Fleming was reminiscing about when Dunham first came to us in October of 03. And it reminded me of the first time I met him, when he and six other NCOs from 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines had came over to 3-7 because they were too short to deploy with 3-4. And I told them that I believed in three things as a Marine: in leadership by example, in self-sacrifice for the greater good, and that one man can make a difference. And, you know, in the 2 years since that incident, I hadn't thought about that moment when I had first met him until that night before giving that talk in Scio. And it hit me that those three principles, Corporal Dunham personified, epitomized them.
On that day in Karabila, Iraq, there was an ambush. You know these events well. You were very nearby. He ended up covering, essentially leaping on a grenade with his helmet and his body to save two fellow Marines. What happened that day, Major Gibson?
Well, sir, it was actually Corporal Dunham's first patrol as a dedicated patrol leader. And when we went out that morning, we did a rehearsal beforehand of react to enemy contact from a mounted patrol. And the rehearsal didn't go exactly as it should have, and I called in Corporal Dunham and his two fire team leaders, Lance Corporal Carbajal and Lance Corporal Hampton. And we did a quick debrief and covered the things that went wrong. And I remember that look in his eyes. He felt like he had let me down by not having a perfect rehearsal. So I slapped him on the shoulder and said, "Hey, it's no problem. You know, we'll fix the problems and we'll drive on. Let's get this mission done." And we went into zone and coordinated with some police in order to have a patrolling operation with them. It was going to last 4 days. And our battalion commander was there with us, and then he left while we scouted out a site for me to put the company in for this patrolling operation. And then we heard some explosions to the west, and Corporal Dunham came to me and said, "Hey, I think Lehman's getting hit." So I said, "Well, let's go get him." And we took off. We linked up with the trucks, and once we got to the HK Triangle, we figured out that it wasn't Lima Company's position getting hit, but the battalion commander's patrol had been ambushed. And RPG flew over the vehicle in front of me, and we realized we had arrived at the ambush site. So we got out of the vehicles and got up against a wall for cover, and Corporal Dunham came to me and said, "Hey, I'm going to take Hampton's fire team, and we'll go south on the east side, and then you go with Carbajal, and you guys go on the west." Mm-hmm. So we started clearing out the ambush, and came across some vehicles in a column that were trying to get through that village and away from the ambush site. And some of those had been involved in the ambush. And a column of vehicles that Corporal Dunham and Hampton's fire team stopped had some insurgents in it. And Corporal Dunham went right for a Toyota Land Cruiser with four military-age males in it. Three of them got out and ran away, and then started exchanging fire with the platoon sergeant, Staff Sergeant Ferguson. At the same time, his point man, PFC Miller, called out to Corporal Dunham that they had weapons in the vehicle. And at the same time that he called that out, the driver of that vehicle jumped out and tried to choke Corporal Dunham.
Mm-hmm.
And Corporal Dunham took him to the ground, and in the ensuing struggle, a grenade came out. And Corporal Dunham called out a warning to his Marines, PFC Miller, who was trying to choke that insurgent out, and Lance Corporal Hampton, the fire team leader, who was running up to help. And the grenade went off, and we later figured out that Corporal Dunham had pulled his helmet off and covered the grenade with the helmet and his body in order to try and defuse the blast.
The Medal of Honor citation that was read at the White House reads, "Aware of the imminent danger and without hesitation, Corporal Dunham covered the grenade with his helmet and body bearing the brunt of the explosion and shielding his Marines from the blast in an ultimate and selfless act of bravery in which he was mortally wounded. He saved the lives of at least two fellow Marines." Major Gibson, that can seem very far away from the daily experience of many Americans, with even as many years as this war has gone on. How do you wish Americans would think about the servicemen and women who are still out there now with all the controversy and everything else around this war, serving day in and day out, many of them ready to make that sacrifice? How should we be thinking of them?
I think we should just remember that the lives that we lead here stateside are a world away from the lives that our fellow citizens are leading right now, and sacrificing the things that we take for granted daily in order to fight our nation's enemies. It's just really a matter of perspective and of reminding oneself how good you've got it, and to not take the petty little things that occur to us day to day as anything significant.
Major Trent Gibson, we're taking nothing for granted today, and we thank you for joining us to share the story, remind us of the story of Jason Dunham, Medal of Honor winner. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jack Beatty, Jason Dunham's mom, said at the White House in an interview as she was getting ready to go to the White House to receive that medal that she wished her son could receive it himself. But that's not the way it works when it comes to these things.
Now, about 80%, according to studies, of Medal of Honor are awarded posthumously, especially to enlisted men. It was created in the Civil War, and afterwards there were many of them given out. And so in the 1890s, a new policy was adopted, and what was required was incontestable proof will be exacted. Requires two witnesses, and the Senate laid down even more stringent criteria that really, I think, lights up how extraordinary these deeds are. The deed must be so outstanding that it clearly distinguishes his gallantry beyond the call of duty from lesser forms of bravery. It must involve the risk of his life, and it must be the type of deed which, if he had not done it, would not subject him to any justified criticism.
We're going to hear men and women who have served right next to those who have sacrificed in so many ways, including, as you heard in the citation, they're the ultimate sacrifice in these wars since 9/11. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This Memorial Day weekend, we are talking with U.S. military men and women about lost comrades, soldiers, and Marines who have died in the wars since 9/11. Jack Beatty joins me. We're going to hear a lot of stories in this hour, important stories for Americans to hear. We'd be happy to hear from you. Is there someone you would like us to be remembering on this Memorial Day? And what are your thoughts, your prayers for the dead and the many wounded in these wars? Jack Beatty is with us. We're joined right now from Seattle by Jack Lewis. He served in the U.S. Army Reserves for 20 years, was discharged honorably 2006, served as sergeant in Iraq from September 04 to July 05, was based in Mosul and Tal Afar. While he was in Iraq, his comrade, Army Sergeant Donald Griffin, was killed in an ambush on March 11, 2005, during an operation in Tal Afar. He's writing a memoir of his tour now. Jack Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello. Nice to be here, in a sense.
Yes. Important to be here, though. Tell us about Donald Griffith and how he died.
I'm sorry. I need to make one quick correction. I've served 9 years total.
Duly noted. Thank you. Remind us of Donald Griffith. You say he was a big guy, a guy out of Iowa.
He was a good-sized guy, around 6 feet or so. Griff was just one of those guys who kind of quietly made everything around him run a little easier. He and I weren't on the same team. I had a PSYOP team, and he had a human team, human intelligence collectors. We both supported the squadron, so with our teams, and then we did direct support to the troops, kind of, you know, individually underground, so we'd run into each other from time to time. He was always sort of friendly, competent, smiled a lot, kept his people going, one thing I remember in particular, our supported colonel and I didn't get along too well. We had a little difference of personalities. Mm. And at one point, he basically, the colonel essentially denied me access to the intel shed, which made my job very, very difficult. So Griff and I kind of set up a back channel, and he got me the info that I needed to keep my job flowing correctly.
Staff Sergeant Griffith was in intelligence, but on the night that he died, he was straight up out fighting. What happened that night, Jack Lewis?
You know, Griff was described by his captain of the troop that he supported directly, which was Blackjack Troop. Captain Walters described him, I think, quite accurately as always the first guy on the truck, usually the last guy off the truck, and usually the last guy back on. You know, ramp dropped on his striker, and he was often moving and going and performing every single time. The night that Griff was killed, he had followed some insurgents that they'd interdicted along their mission route. Followed them down into a wadi, and he was ambushed there. He was out in the lead. The guy was fast. Out in the lead, he was moving, scanning, and he ran into AK ambush, which he had sustained several gunshot wounds, and managed to get a warning to his to the Cav Scouts that were following him, so that they weren't also ambushed.
There was a lot of blood once they got him back in the striker. As for the 20 minutes or so, as the life ebbed out of him, you remind us, Jack Lewis, that back in his hometown of Mechanicsburg, Iowa, more than 200 townspeople were at his parents' door within 24 hours of the hard news.
Yeah, I always have thought that's one of the more wonderful things about small towns, and it reminded me to some extent of the fact of the way that our FOB was kind of like a small town. You just had to take care of the people around you because, well, they were your people. They were the only people there were.
They're the people
Griff exemplified that better than anybody, really.
These are the people who are fighting the wars that we have our country in. Jack Lewis, thank you very much for remembering Army Staff Sergeant Donald Griffith with us today.
Thank you.
Let me take a call from Isla in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Isla, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to remember my stepbrother, Lieutenant Colonel Michael McMahon. He was killed in a plane crash in 2004 in Afghanistan. And the plane crash was basically caused by two pilots who were being paid by Blackwater as independent contractors, who essentially had never flown in those conditions, had never been really vetted by the U.S. government, and they essentially flew the plane directly into a mountain. And I just want to say it's important, as much as we love and support our troops, that our government needs to be just behind them.
Isla, we hear that loud and clear, and we're sorry for the loss of your stepbrother, and in those circumstances, especially. It's Memorial Day, and it's time to think of exactly those, and every day, time to keep those sacrifices in mind. I want to bring on another guest now. Jason Christopher Hartley joins us from New Platts, New York. He's author of Just Another Soldier, A Year on the Ground in Iraq, Sergeant in the New York Army National Guard Alpha Company, 1st of the 69th Infantry. He's still active duty. Jason Christopher Hartley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You wanted to remember a friend, Sigun Frederick Akinadi, killed in October 2004. Tell us about him.
Akintadi was an immigrant from Nigeria. I moved to New York City from Utah in 2000, and he had moved to New York City about the same time. So we joined the unit pretty much at about the same time when we met each other. We had known each other for several years. The units in New York City tend to be very ethnically diverse just because of, you know, virtue of being New York City. And, usually the groups the guys kind of tend to hang out with are sometimes divided down racial lines. Everyone gets along. Everyone's pretty tight. But, you know, kind of like the cliques the guys always kind of move within are usually, you know, it's basically like two white guys and everyone's Spanish. There's like a handful of black guys. But what's interesting is that when we deployed to Iraq is kind of ironically one of the most unifying things we had as a platoon, where we're all kind of stuck in this, we were living out of what was essentially an ammo bunker for one of the air bases that Saddam had, you know, back during while he was with his regime. And so the platoon's like 36 guys, it's pretty tight quarters, and we spent a lot of time playing video games, and ironically the games we would play very closely resembled our job. We're in the infantry, so we, you know, we'd, during the day, we'd go out, go house to house, room to room, looking for bad guys, and then we'd come back to our bunker and do kind of the same thing with the video games. But it was, I was always kind of like a unifying thing, was to come back and hang out and play the games. And whenever the guys get together and we kind of talk about Akintadi and what we remember about him, the one thing we almost always talk about is he had this laugh. He had this really deep laugh, like he kind of sounded like the guy that's from the 7-Up commercials. He had this laugh, like, ha, ha, ha. We play these games.
Colon nut guy. Specialist Akintadi was a Nigerian immigrant to the United States.
Yeah, and in fact, he had just recently received his citizenship. He'd been an American citizen for probably about a year before he was killed.
How did he die, Jason?
Well, we were in a small town about 45 miles north of Baghdad, and we did all of our missions out of Humvees. We had the armored Humvees. And he was a machine gunner, which was probably one of the more dangerous positions for a soldier to be in that area. But it was pretty much a typical day. We had found a very large cache of weapons kind of out in a more remote part of our area of operations. And a small convoy of Humvees, one of which he was in, went out to secure that cache. And it was, ended up being essentially an ambush, kind of a small, tight road. Had an IED in place in it, and it was just kind of like that one in a million shot where a piece of shrapnel just, you know, was able to go high enough above the armor that surrounded the turret and low enough that it was able to go below his helmet and struck him in the back of the skull and killed him instantly.
He had a big, deep voice, you say. If you could talk with him today, what do you wish you could say that you didn't get to before that day?
No, I guess that I had recently been promoted to sergeant, and it's always kind of a struggle, you know, as a low-ranking NCO in the military to kind of maintain control of guys, and Akintadi was such a good-natured dude, and he was always kind of like, you know, goofing off. He was really kind of a happy-go-lucky guy, and I sometimes had a difficult time kind of trying to rein him in and maintain some kind of order, and it was more kind of a matter of my own insecurities rather than a matter of him, you know, doing anything wrong. And I guess that's the one thing that if I wish that I, you know, if he were around still today, that I wish I could talk to him about, is I think he kind of got the impression that, like, that I didn't like him because I was, you know, struggling as a young leader, and which wasn't the case at all. And, yeah, I guess if there's one thing that I wish I could talk to him about, it would probably be that. I wish we could have been closer, you know, but that's not really how it was.
He's gone. Sergeant Hartley, please stand by. Let me take a call from Columbia, South Carolina, and Ron. Ron, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Hi. I'd like us to remember a good friend. He was my good friend in Fallujah, 2004. I was on a 10-man team on a special operations team in Fallujah. We couldn't have done what we did without him. He was a retired Captain Muhammad from the Iraqi Special Forces, had retired a couple of years before the war started. And everybody in this neighborhood we were in knew that he was helping us. He drove a red car in and out of the base every day, but he's one of the few Iraqis that saw the new Iraq. He saw it because he did his job every day helping us, because he believed that the new Iraq was there and he was going to work every day in front of his town and neighborhood to say, look, this is the new Iraq. I'm helping these guys. And he taught me a lot about life, about taking care of your family in spite of people ostracizing you or whatever they think. He had 8 kids. I met a lot of the adult kids that he had. He was still making sure that they got to work and to college, even through all of these different things. And he had to pay the ultimate price for helping us do our mission, and we couldn't have done it without him.
Ron, you're good and generous to remember the Iraqi Captain Muhammad, who died there with you in Fallujah. Let's get another call from John, Norwood, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you.
I'd like to remember my friend, Corporal Seamus Davy. He served with 2nd Force Recon in Iraq. He was killed in 2005. His actions directly saved 2 other Marines' lives. He was awarded posthumously the Bronze Star with Combat V. I know Seamus. I served with him before in Marine Corps Rifle Company. However, I got out in 2002. And when it came time for him to get out, instead of him just getting out of the Marine Corps completely, he chose to go to a reserve force recon unit, 4th Force Recon, located in Reno at the time. And that's an elite unit for those that don't know what force recon is. Combat scuba, halo jumping, you know, parachute stuff. And, you know, he was always an elite Marine, you know, the entire time he was in. You know, he was always on top of the physical training and, you know, weapon skills and stuff. He knew all that stuff, you know, to a T. And then he chose to stay in. And, you know, he got activated. And on his third tour over there, you know, that's when everything ended for him. But I just wanted to, excuse me, call and remember him.
John, we remember him right with you, shoulder to shoulder with you. Marine Corporal Seamus Davy died in Anbar, October 21st, 2005. Thank you very much for your call and for his service. I want to welcome right now Talia Havis, active duty Marine and ROTC student at Harvard College. She worked in intelligence in Iraq and Afghanistan, spent her freshman year at Harvard, then left after 9/11 to spend 5 years on active duty in the Marines. She was in the Fallujah area on June 23, 2005, when a convoy carrying many of her fellow Marines, many of them women, was ambushed. 13 were wounded, 6 died. Talia Havis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for doing this show.
Can you tell us about these women and what they were doing on the outskirts of Fallujah?
I wanted to share their story, sort of in the spirit of Memorial Day. They were working at the checkpoints that surround the city of Fallujah. They were searching the Iraqi women as they would come into the city. There were 17 girls on a search team, and they lived at Camp Fallujah with us, and every day they would convoy into the city. And on June 23rd, a suicide vehicle-borne IED, basically a suicide car bomb, hit their convoy. The Marines, they were riding in a 7-ton truck, and the car bomb detonated under the gas tank of the truck. And 6 of the Marines and sailors were killed, including 3 of the women on the search team. You know, they were my friends, and we lived together. You know, we shared a shower trailer, and we shared cookies from home and care packages and terrible romance novels. And, you know, now when I'm back here in Boston and I see a group of girls walking down the street laughing with their friends, yeah, I often think of them, because that's how I remember them. They were really goofy. They were full of life. They were just girls. They were enjoying their lives. They were enjoying their lives, like, on Camp Fallujah, just as they would have in California or New York. But really, they were more than just girls, and they were more than just my friends. They were part of something bigger than they were. They really believed in it, you know. They believed in what they were doing.
Talia, please stand by for just a moment. We want to hear more of that story and remember the women you're talking about right there. Jason Christopher Hartley, author of Just Another Soldier, A Year on the Ground in Iraq. What do you say to Americans listening today on this Memorial Day weekend about how they ought to think of these sacrifices, Jason?
Well, I think that there's something that we as a nation, as, you know, Western civilization, have done a lot better this time around with this war as opposed to, say, wars in recent history, is the sentiment that you can be against the war and be for the troops. Sometimes people have a problem with that. They think there's, you know, cognitive dissonance if you believe that. But I have no problem with that. I think that it makes me proud to see people that are able to express themselves intellectually, even if it's in conflict with maybe certain ideas, but still have a strong support for the troops themselves. And, you know, sometimes people ask, well, what exactly does support entail? Something as simple as maintaining contacts in an email. There's a message for a lot of soldiers who are in Iraq, you know.
And maybe something as simple as remembering today. Sergeant Hartley, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On this Memorial Day weekend, we are talking with U.S. military men and women about lost comrades, soldiers, and Marines who have died in the wars since 9/11. You can join us. How do we properly honor sacrifice in wars in which such a small portion of the country is serving? Jack Beatty's with us. Let's take a call from Aaron in Bedford, New Hampshire. Aaron, you're on the air.
I'd like to remember my little brother, First Lieutenant Michael Cleary, who was killed in action in Taji, Iraq on December 20th, 2005. And I, first of all, want to thank you so much for allowing people to share their stories and also people an opportunity to hear how special these folks are.
Lieutenant Michael Cleary died in Taji, yes. 2005. Do you know how he died, Aaron?
I do. Actually, he had just completed his last mission. He was to come home in 8 days. He was an EOD officer, and they had just destroyed a bomb factory. And on the way back to his FOB, they hit an IED and were ambushed.
We remember your brother, your baby brother, as you say, Michael, today. Aaron, thank you very much for your call. Marine Sergeant Talia Havas is with us. She was in Fallujah when 13 troops were wounded in an incident that she was right next to there. Six died on that day. Sergeant Havas, as I understand it, you went into the checkpoint after these women had been there. You saw their graffiti on the walls, these women, these Marines who had been serving at checkpoints on the way into Fallujah. You knew their lives. You saw what they left behind on that, essentially, battlefront, even though women aren't supposed to exactly be on the battlefront in American wars.
Well, we volunteered to replace them. It was really the only way we had of honoring our friends, is to continue to carry out the mission, to sort of pick up where they left off, you know, to follow in their footsteps. And they were very much with us over that next month as we worked in the checkpoints. You know, we did, as you said, They'd written all these translations of useful Iraqi phrases on the walls of the checkpoints, and I'd be sitting there searching frantically for the particular phrase that I desperately needed at that moment, and I'd, you know, see a little KC Loves New York City scrawled at the bottom, and you just stop, and it would become very personal. But somehow it put it into perspective, because you'd be standing there on the outskirts of Fallujah, surrounded by Iraqi women, doing the job that was so important to these girls, that it becomes so important to us, and it sort of balanced the personal loss with what they were part of and the mission that we all believed in and what we were there for.
We want to remember them by name, those who died on that day in that ambush, whose boots you stepped into practically. Marine Corporal Ramona Valdez, she was 20 years old, Bronx in New York. Navy Petty Officer First Class Regina Clark, she was 43, of Centralia, Washington. Marine Lance Corporal Holly A. Charette, 21, Cranston, Rhode Island. And Marine Lance Corporal Vishna Mui of Los Angeles, 20 years old. Marine Corporal Chad Powell, 22, West Monroe, Louisiana. Marine Corporal Carlos Pineda, 23, of Los Angeles, California. All died on that day. Talia Havas, Sergeant Havas, thank you very much for helping us remember them.
Thank you.
Let's go to Lou in Buffalo, New York. Lou, you're on the air.
Yes, I was talking with the screener, and I guess I was, you know, thank you for taking my call. I was still shook up with the Jason Dunham explanation. Very, very profound. I'm a father of a Marine. He's on his third deployment, two in Iraq, Fallujah and Ramadi, and right now he's in Afghanistan. And I guess I just wanted to make a comment that, from the bottom of my heart, because for me this is all very personal, and I just want to take my hat off to all the service men and women for doing what they're doing. And for the most part, without really much in terms of recognition from the public. I mean, they're doing what they're doing without much recognition at all, because it's a professional military. So it's not a draft. It's not broad based. So my hats go off to all of them. And I guess I just wanted to ask a quick question of the sergeant, the Marine that was just on,
yes.
Talia. The women, because, I mean, if it is, I just want her to know that I do include them women in my prayers every week at church. Are those the Marines that the Marines have come to refer to as the lionesses? And I'll listen to your comments and the answer to the question off the air. And Tom, thanks again, and thanks to all the men and women. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lou, and thanks for your son's service. We don't have Sergeant Havis with us at the moment. The lionesses, I'm not sure. We'll see if we can find out, but thanks for your call. I want to go right now to Dan Murphy. He's the father of Michael P. Murphy, the only serviceman to win the Medal of Honor in Afghanistan. Mr. Murphy, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, thank you for having me.
We just heard from Lou there in Buffalo, New York. His son is in the Marines in Afghanistan. Your son was in the Navy SEALs, and in a mission that became famous, gave his life to try and save those who were pinned down by almost 100 Taliban fighters there, June 2005. He and three fellow SEALs lost their lives there in the mountains. How do you remember him? You and your family remember him now, Mr. Murphy?
Well, as we try and remember Michael and his teammates. I had met most of them, and they're probably some of the bravest men I've ever met in my life. And we try and... remember them through tributes to not only Michael, because as much as Michael sacrificed his life for his team sacrificed their lives for him. I mean, there were, in fact, we lost 11 SEALs that day, the most, I think, that Navy Special Warfare has ever lost in one engagement.
Because the rescue team that came in after your son gave his life to get up on the ridge and make that radio call, the rescue team that came in also got shot down in their Chinook helicopter there.
Yeah, there were eight. There were eight Navy SEALs. The other half of Michael's team and part of SEAL Team 10 were on that helicopter, along with eight members of the 160th Airborne Group. The Night Stalkers were coming in to reinforce Michael's position based upon the call that he made, and I guess his citation had to do with him stepping out. I think Marcus Luttrell said it best in his book, Lone Survivor. Michael stepped out into an avalanche of bullets in order to get a clear signal on his satellite phone back to base camp to report his condition and the situation, which resulted in those reinforcement team coming in.
Managed to contact Bagram Air Base, got up out of that ravine, up on a ridge where he could make radio contact. But it wasn't...
Yes, he had to step out from their cover positions, which were on the side of those ravines. He had to step out into the middle of the ravine. But, I mean, any one of them would have done that in the same situation. I mean, we're talking about a truly extraordinary men.
Mm. Jack Beatty, we just heard from Lou in Buffalo, whose son is there now in Afghanistan serving. We've got Dan Murphy, whose son won the Medal of Honor, giving his life there in Afghanistan. Those are cold mountainsides, a long way from our everyday life, Jack.
They are, and my sympathy and my and I think all listeners feel abiding admiration for your son's service. You know, you often hear people say we have to stay in these wars because the sacrifices will be in vain if we leave. Nothing could be further from the truth. There's nothing in vain about people dying for other people. What could be more meaningful? The moral realities of war, the self-sacrifice, men risking and dying for other people, that has nothing to do with the political outcomes of war. And so I think these are all what could be more meaningful than this? And, you know, isn't it terrible, though, in some ways, that this exemplary behavior has to come out in war, that we have to see this sacrifice like this and heroism, that it defines, that it needs this terrible frame to emerge. It may be the only thing that I won't say redeems, but at least mitigates the tragedy and horror of war.
Dan Murphy, you've said that your son Michael, even as a young boy, long before he was in the service in the Navy SEALs, he always showed this kind of character, the protector character. He would step up to protect people who needed help.
Oh, I think, Michael, I mean, Michael was a hero long before he put a uniform on, and I think if anyone has any sense of these men in Naval Special Operations, they are so much like each other. They are all truly altruistic and giving. I think each of them, if you were to ever to look at either, you know, Eric Christensen or Dan Healy or Jeff Taylor, any, you know, Mike McGreevy, they are all men, I think, even growing up, like Michael, who were very giving of themselves even then, in order to endure what they had to endure and the sacrifices they have to make and had to make to do what they did. I think that just didn't develop when they were men. That was their sense of character and purpose when they were younger, and I think it's reflected in even the men and women that we see today in the armed services, because, I mean, this is a volunteer army. They're all there to do it because they have a sense of wanting to give back to the country, and they want to do something for other people. And so, I know my hat's off to not only our armed services, but our uniformed personnel, fire and police. They're out on the front lines protecting us every day.
Dan Murphy, and father of Lieutenant Michael P. Murphy, Navy SEAL, who gave his life in the mountains of Afghanistan and was honored with the Medal of Honor for that service. Mr. Murphy, thank you so much for reminding us of your son's story, and thank you for your family's sacrifice.
Thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to talk to the nation about my son and his very brave compatriots. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for one more story today. Joining us from Milford, Massachusetts, is Sergeant Charles Pinder. He's active in the Massachusetts Army National Guard, Echo Battery, 101st Field Artillery. He was just a few inches away from Sergeant Michael Kelly in Afghanistan when Sergeant Kelly was hit by shrapnel and killed on June 8, 2005. The Massachusetts National Guard is dedicating a new tactical training base to Sergeant Kelly next month, June 7th. Sergeant Pinder, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you, sir. How are you doing?
We're all right. Remind us of the character of Sergeant Michael Kelly.
Sergeant Kelly was an extremely quiet person. He was very, not shy, but he's very reserved. You basically had to pry your way into getting into, like, I don't know, this little inner circle. But once you were able to get into it, you know, past the barriers and everything else, he's actually a remarkable person. He would do anything that he could to help you out. He'd share jokes. He'd give as much advice as he possibly could. And he'd just try to make sure that everyone's day was better than the last.
He loved Chris Farley and Star Wars movies, graduated Scituate High School in 1997. On June 8th, 2005, he had been in Afghanistan for just a couple of months on tour. You were right next to him. What happened that day, Sergeant Pinder?
We were unloading a Chinook, and we took some enemy fire. We took rockets from one of the local mountain ranges, and it landed pretty close to us. I don't exactly know how close in terms of meters, but he took a couple of pieces of shrapnel and did some pretty significant damage.
You were about 6 inches from Sergeant Kelly when he died. How do you now think about his sacrifice and those of the many others that we're hearing about on this Memorial Day weekend, Sergeant Pinder?
The service that they did was unparalleled by none. I mean, we just can't forget them. The sacrifices they made, we can't let them go in vain.
He watched the last Star Wars movie with you the night before he died. He was a fan. I mean, he was enjoying life as well as you could in that circumstance, in the way that he liked, almost to the end there.
Yes, sir. We actually set up the computer and speakers and whole nine yards and basically had our own little private showing of the last Star Wars, and he loved it so much. If I remember correctly, he actually watched it two more times that night. He was just thrilled that he could finally see the entire series of Star Wars basically unfold. He played the games. He was able to quote every single movie and tell you everything that happened from beginning to end, and he was ecstatic.
And the next day, Sergeant Michael J. Kelly's life ended there in Afghanistan. Sergeant Pinder, thank you for remembering him with us today, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, sir, and I also want to say thank you to the Kelly family who is listening right now.
Our thanks to them for their family service. One last call. Kristen, Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, and I'm really glad to hear this, this show. I wanted to just take a minute to remember my brother, Dale James Kelly Jr. He was a staff sergeant from a mountain company in Maine, and he was killed on May 6, 2006. Also, his CO, Christopher Varkas, who between the two of them managed to or helped to save the life of the third member of their team. They were in a truck securing a convoy in southern Iraq when they were hit by an IED. And Christopher, the CEO, actually threw himself on top of the young gunner. And my brother was the medic in his battalion, and he had taught everyone how to put in their own IVs just in case he wasn't around to do it. And because of those two actions, the third member of their team came out alive. I'm so glad that you're doing this story today, because it seems that with all of the numbers of deaths in Iraq and in Afghanistan, that people are becoming almost desensitized to the losses and missing out on sort of the real stories that these are people with families that miss them dearly.
Kristen, we're remembering actively and with respect today, and we appreciate your call. We remember your brother, Army Sergeant Dale James Kelly Jr. Jack, another Memorial Day, and I'm grateful to you for riding along as we hear stories from people who have given everything, their families, their brothers, their children.
Yes, and we've heard about their laughter, and Siegfried Sassoon, the war poet, wrote, "Pray that you may never know the hell where youth and laughter go."
There's a photo gallery of the men and women mentioned on this show at onpointradio.org. See it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.